Obama, Clinton with a tan. As rumblings of discontent arose in the wake of the extension of the Bush-era tax cuts by the Obama administration, President Barack Obama pulled out his secret weapon, former President William Jefferson Clinton. Clinton before a bank of microphones is always a sight to behold, for few politicians have his mix of pure intelligence, down-home folksy charm, and sheer performance skills. It is a measure of our politics that the system elected a man who was virtually a clone of Clinton, born to poor and working-class people, educated in Ivy League schools, advocates of globalism and neoliberalism, and servants of the business class. When we recollect the acrimony and bad blood that flowed between the two camps during the campaign and the post-election integration and indeed immersion of Clintonites into all levels of the Obama administration, why should we be surprised when the president runs into a bad squall and he calls out Bill Clinton? Bill Clinton, perhaps the most talented politician of his generation, was also the head salesman of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, the pact that dealt a body blow to the very same working class that would be implored to vote for Hillary Clinton back in 2008. We have forgotten the almost comic H. Ross Perot, the independent who opposed Clinton and Bush during the 1992 and 96 elections, based primarily on his anti-NAFTA stance. Perot warned, in so many words, "If you pass that NAFTA, all you'll hear is a giant sucking sound of jobs and manufacturers gone to Mexico." People laughed at his Texas twang, his big ears, and his lack of height, while Bush and Clinton poo-pooed his warnings as silly. We live now amidst the post-NAFTA carnage that has brought mass disaster to both countries. Only the rich and super-rich benefited from NAFTA, as workers in the USA adapted to the new and grim economic realities, and workers in Mexico either joined the drug industry or fled up north to the U.S. to find work in the fields of agriculture or carpentry. It is therefore fitting that Obama would call on Clinton, for the man who could sell ice to the Inuits or sand to the Saudis can surely sell this perverse notion of tax cuts to billionaires. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. The WikiLeaks effect. As these words are being spoken, U.S. allies in the Middle East are trembling. From the streets of Tunis to Alexandria to Cairo, tens of thousands are demanding not only democracy, but an end to their dictatorships. Dictatorships that are, by the way, armed and supported by the U.S. empire. What drove these people into the streets were the wiki revelations of the puppetry, corruption, and servility of their leaders to U.S. and Western interests. Many of these leaders, who've led for lifetimes, have amassed enormous wealth while generations of youth pass through life jobless, unfulfilled, and brutally bullied by the police forces of the dictatorships, often police trained, equipped, or both by U.S. agencies. WikiLeaks revealed American diplomatic cables reflecting U.S. knowledge and acquiescence of their puppet state's corruption, torture, and brutality. They didn't care how cruel nor corrupt these countries were, as long as they served U.S. interests, that is, stability or quiet in the face of U.S., Western, or Israeli aggression in the region. Egypt receives billions of U.S. bucks every year to buttress its dictatorship. This spate of rebellions in Muslim states is especially important given the recent news that many leaders were privately urging the U.S. to attack Iran. For this shows that few spoke for their people. They spoke for a narrow, parasitical ruling clique. If change comes to the region, it won't be because of U.S. efforts, but in spite of them. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Allies of Empire? If students of current affairs learned anything this past week, it is that Egypt is not Tunisia. When the people took to the streets of Tunis in their masses, the Ben Ali clan took the hint packed up their loot, and split. Hosni Mubarak is no Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. A former general, Mubarak is a creature of the military. And much like Pakistan, being an ally of the world's richest country has paid dividends to a whole cohort of the military, the better to protect a military dictatorship. They have grown fat and corrupt on a generation of U.S. money, and they don't want to give it up. That's why you see Mubarak's thugs beating protesters in broad daylight, lobbing Molotov cocktails at unarmed civilians, and terrorizing journalists. They don't want the bakshish to end. And those thugs? Cops, mostly, out of uniform. The problem in Egypt has never been just a dictator. It's been the dictatorship, a system of repression and terrorism, which has been supported by the U.S. for decades. Why do you think the army is so strong? To fight Israel? Libya? The Sudan? Nope. It's to keep the people in check, in fear, in terror. It ain't to protect them, for the army is the tool of Mubarak and those that pay him. A recent Newsweek article called the array of U.S. allies in the Middle East mafia states, designed to enrich families and serve the empire. The people are incidental, means to an end. But if they are mafia states, the unasked and unanswered question is, who is the Don? Further, this journalistic description, while appealing, isn't entirely accurate, for these nations are vampire states, draining the lifeblood, spirits, and dreams of the people. They are parasite states, lifeless relics of a bygone era that must be sternly fought for the light of freedom to dawn over Arab skies. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Egypt, a good beginning. The events in Egypt of the past few weeks have raised more questions than answers. And while things seem in a state of flux, some things are clear among them. One, revolutions don't just change rulers, but systems. Two, revolutions designed to gain democracy cannot lead to military rule, for the two are ever in conflict. And three, the Egyptian struggle is at its beginning, not its end. The forced resignation of Hosni Mubarak from the reins of power was accomplished by a convergence of forces. The demonstrations in Cairo, Alexandria, and throughout the nation, pressure from business interests who lost billions from empty tourism buses, and from anxious elements in the military who saw the potential of greater and greater chaos and perhaps loss of power. Mubarak didn't go easily or willingly, and his choice of Omar Suleiman as his number two would have been, at any other time, considered a masterstroke. For Suleiman's primary distinction was his expertise in torture. This was designed to send a ripple of fear and dread throughout Tahrir Square. Surprisingly, it had the opposite effect. It spurred new resistance and hastened his departure. But power ill rests in the hands of military, as the Tunisian and Egyptian experiences illustrate. Both Ben Ali and Mubarak were military men who depended on force to preserve their power and to control dissidents. In Tunisia, Ben Ali bore both titles, president and general. Mubarak was a fighter pilot. Thus, their instincts were to fight, not reason. The eruption in Egypt had its origin in the desperation of Mohamed Abu Azizi of Tunisia, who, after repeated tries for justice from an unresponsive and corrupt regime, set himself aflame. Abu Azizi was a 26-year-old man who earned a PhD, couldn't find a job, worked as a fruit vendor, and had his wares illegally seized by police. The fire he lit took his life, but inspired millions of Tunisians, who in turn sparked millions of Egyptians to rebel. Who knows how far these fires will rage? Egypt may be on a long road to awaken from its slumber, but this is the road's beginning, not its end. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. What the Arab rebellions mean Day by day, like a fever, rebellions pass from city to city, Tunis, Cairo, Manama, Sana'a, Benghazi, and beyond. For the Arab world, saddled with venal, greedy, and repressive governments for decades, many of which have failed to provide basic economic, social, or job security to most of its citizens or subjects, this has been the season of rebellion, especially among the young. In Egypt, for example, many young men know that joblessness meant no chance for marriage. Some drifted to the mosque. Some joined the Muslim Brotherhood. Others fell into hopelessness. These rebellions brought hope for change. Almost all of the Arab rebellions can be traced to more substantial causes, principally the brutality and corruption of the police. But rebellions are beginnings. Revolutions, they are not. Again, Egypt is illustrative of that fact, perhaps best shown by the role of the army. For although at the time Tahrir Square was full, people chanted, "The army and the people are one," within days of that euphoria, people are being beaten, jailed, and taken before military courts for protesting. One demonstrator, beaten by soldiers, expressed shock, saying, "I thought we were brothers." The faces at the top may have changed, but the system hasn't. Nor have the recent rebellions been in any way an affirmation of the American invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. Indeed, the reverse is true. American politicians and neocon ideologues sold Iraq as a stellar example of regional democracy. It has been a horror of bloodletting, social upheaval, ethnic hatreds, and political corruption in both Iraq and Afghanistan on a grand scale. In that sense, they've proven more an equal than an exemplar, for they excel in stolen elections. Indeed, in these U.S. puppet states, supported by vast sums of American money, there's protests aplenty against the U.S.-backed regimes. Boy, half a trillion in U.S. dollars for stolen elections. Does this sound like money well spent? The rebellions continue, though at a slower pace than a month ago, though I'm willing to bet the season's not over. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Revolutions to come. As fires of rebellion and resistance flash through ancient Arab cities, the nation's pundits, especially those of the rightish variety, warn us of a pending doom in the form of rising gas prices and the bugaboo of near-hysterical proportions, Islamists. But there's a funny thing about rebellions and revolutions. They may begin one way, but no one knows where they will end. That's the nature of revolutions. The voices of America's pundit class have apparently forgotten that the founders that they like to revere and praise as prophets of freedom were, well, revolutionaries, who stood against the most powerful empire of the age, the British, with little help and money from the French. The very notion of having a nation without a king was, well, a revolutionary idea. That's why when France had its revolution a few years later, the crowned heads of Europe got together, conspired really, to beat them into the ground. For back in those days, the conventional wisdom was that kings and queens ruled by the will of God, hence the divine right of kings. The American, French, and Haitian revolutions put a real dent into such notions. Abe Lincoln, speaking as a congressman in 1848, told his fellow members, "It is a quality of revolutions not to go by old lines and old laws, but to break up both and make new ones." The forces roiling today in several North African and Persian Gulf countries have been held in check for generations by powerful, repressive, and ruthless governments, many of whom have been staunch U.S. allies. The forces which have been unleashed in recent weeks threatens to upend many, if not most, of the old relationships and understandings that form the basis of U.S. Mideast policy. Remarkably, none of the experts on the region, few of the scholars, and virtually none of the talking heads on TV and cable had a clue until the dam broke and the boiling rage burst forth. We have no idea when or where these forces will dissipate. They may radiate for years. They may indeed spill out into other areas of the world. That, too, is the nature of revolution. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu
commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Bombing his own people? As pro- and anti-government forces battle for supremacy in the cities and deserts of Libya in North Africa, the tenor and tone of U.S. and Western reporting puts the lie to the often-heard claim of objectivity in the news. The cheerleading seems more apt for ESPN than on the nation's leading news channels, spurred, of course, by U.S. enmity against Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, who has long been a thorn in the side of U.S. imperial designs in that region. Let us not pretend that American efforts are caused by solicitude for the suffering of Libyan people, for easily 10 times that number suffered under Egypt's president for life and U.S. ally, Hosni Mubarak, and the U.S. turned a deaf ear to their cries. Only when the people rose up and took the stage did the U.S. start mumbling phrases about human rights and violence. This from a government that secretly sent and may still be sending men to Egyptian hellholes to be tortured by rendition and killed by the dreaded secret police. Indeed, anyone with a passing acquaintance with American history cannot even hear the media and political charges of a government attacking or bombing its own people without cringing. For U.S. National Guard attacked students in Kent State, Ohio, killing four college kids who were protesting the Vietnam War. Shortly thereafter, two black kids were killed by cops at Jackson State University in Mississippi during a protest. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania was the site of a government bombing a home, killing men, women, and babies. This was the MOVE bombing of May 13, 1985, where 11 people were bombed to death and a whole city block reduced to rubble. Were any of these bombers brought to justice? And when Israel unleashed Operation Cast Lead against the occupied territories in Gaza, killing over 1,400 Palestinians, men, women, children, and a respected South African judge, Richard Goldstone, issued a report calling the strafings, bombings, and high-caliber shootings of civilians war crimes, what did the Obama administration do? Did it criticize the bombers or the judge? Well, guess. If you guessed the judge, you were right. And it gives you some idea of how much the U.S. government cares about human rights, violence, governments bombing unarmed civilians, or the suffering of Arabs under repressive regimes. Here's the lesson. Rebels in every nation catch hell. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.